We're going to get started here. We'll have the in-between this class and Benny Gesundheit's class, which follows at 12:15 on Sefer Tehillim. We can schmooze a little more, but we do want to get started. And really, it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Yoel Finkelman, who is the curator of the Chaim and Chana Solomon Judaic Collection at the National Library of Israel. He's going to give a class, as you see on the screen, a brief introduction to Hebrew manuscripts. I don't know if I want to call this a career change, Dr. Finkelman also has...
It's a career change.
It is a career change. Okay. He used to teach at Bar-Ilan University, taught in some, I think, the one-year programs for American kids. He was, you know, really a mechanech, and now he's doing, you know, chinuch in a different way, based on National Library, and it's a pleasure. We had him here in Toronto for Torah Motion in his prior career, and now it's a pleasure to welcome him back in career number two to give a talk on Hebrew manuscripts. Bakasha.
Thanks, Jay. I appreciate the invitation, and it's a lot of fun to be here virtually without having to sit on an uncomfortable plane seat for hours and hours. So I want to thank you for the invitation, and I think the plan is to talk for about 45 minutes or so, 45 to 50 minutes, and then if there are questions, probably easier to stick them in the chat, and we can look at those afterwards. So basically the plan for this evening, my time this morning, some of your time, is to do a brief introduction to Hebrew manuscripts. Most of what I'm going to be talking about will come from the collection of the National Library of Israel. The library's collection has about 10,000 Hebrew manuscripts ranging from the 5th, 6th century until the 20th and 21st centuries. We also have a website called Ktiv, which brings together close to 80,000 Hebrew manuscripts from around the world, not only the ones in our collection. So I'll be talking a little bit about manuscripts in our collection, but also about manuscripts from some other collections. And I'm actually going to be less interested in the content and more interested in the physical object and more interested in the social and economic relations, the way in which manuscripts as objects were bought, sold, used, played into the social dynamics of the community. I know that that Jay and Torah in Motion does tons and tons of great content material. So I'm not actually going to talk so much about what the texts say, except to the extent that it relates to how they were put together and how they were created and how they were distributed and how they were sold and how they were used. So let me see if I can then figure out how to get this PowerPoint to move. And the answer is that I can't. That's a little frustrating. Does that help?
No, yeah, it doesn't. No, it was on the side. Maybe if you then click on the next one. Yeah, there you go.
Okay, but do you see the whole background here?
I can see in the main big screen you have types of manuscripts. I see stuff on the side, but that's fine.
All right.
Now you're back to the original screen.
Turn it into a presentation.
Yeah, that's what I thought I had done. All right, let's try this again.
Try F5.
F5. Nope, can't get it to switch.
There you got it.
Oh, I did get
it.
You did have it.
Okay. So I want to actually start, like I mentioned, talking about the physical form, and we're going to start talking about scrolls. People are, for the most part, kind of familiar with a scroll. And a scroll, the most common example in which people in today's Jewish life come into day-to-day contact with a scroll is going to be a mezuzah, which is a text. It's first of all, even before that, manuscript means a text written by hand. That's what it means. And there are all kinds of texts that are written by hand. We still use them today. We write to-do lists. We write shopping lists unless we put them into our phone. We take notes on various things. We still use that today. But the kind of things that we would jot down today in library talk would more be, we would call archives rather than manuscripts. If an important individual, if we had access, I don't know, to, you know, if we have access to Franz Kafka's Hebrew notebooks, several of which we have in the library, Kafka learned and studied Hebrew. So that would be an archival document rather than a manuscript, because it's a reflection of the kind of day-to-day life of a modern person. And manuscript in library term as opposed to archive is usually used in contrast to a printed book. Basically, prior to the 15th century, at least in the West, the way to preserve texts in writing was to copy them by hand. You could not print them in the way that we print them today, or even in the way they were printed with the invention of the printing press with movable type in the 15th century. Although there was printing technology in the Far East, it was much less relevant for Jews. So prior to the printing press, if you wanted to transmit texts or you wanted to record texts, what you had to do was write it down. And you had to write it down by hand, either on papyrus, more or less in Jewish terms, nothing on papyrus survives, or on klaf, on parchment, animal skin, which much more of which survives because it's much more durable, or later, early Middle Ages in North Africa and the East, the High Middle Ages in Europe, paper when it was developed. So by way of introduction. Now, the kind of manuscript that we are familiar with, again, on a day-to-day basis might be a mezuzah. You take a small piece of parchment, a sofer stam, a practiced and professional scribe writes the parshiot of the Shema on the piece of paper, or the piece of parchment, excuse me, which is then rolled up and placed on the doorpost to fulfill the mitzvah of mezuzah. And it's written in a particular script, but there's something anachronistic about a mezuzah. There's something anachronistic about a mezuzah because it is technologically an enormous waste of time, if what you want, and energy and money. If what you want is to record the text, then you don't copy it by hand anymore. You have it printed, you have it typed, you save it on a Word file, you Xerox copy it. We have so many technologies that are available. So today in the 21st century, if we have a scroll like a mezuzah, it's a ritual object, one whose uniqueness and sanctity is related to the fact that we use outdated technology of quill pens and ink and parchment rather than the more updated technology of copy machines, printers, computers, and electronic printers. And the same is true of a Sefer Torah. This happens to be the Sefer Torah that we use for mincha prayers, mincha davening in the National Library on fast days when we have a mincha minyan.
Excuse me, you're not actually sharing your screen.
I'm not sharing my screen. So frustrating. Thanks. How's
activate
that?
Activate and click on share.
How's that?
Perfect. Much better.
Perfect.
Okay. So this is the Sefer Torah that we use in the library, and it's actually a manuscript from the library's collection. It has its call number up here at the top. Here's an example of a 16th or 17th century Megillat Esther, which again is a ritual object. By the 16th, 17th century, it is possible to get copies of the Megillah printed. And so the retroactive or the anachronistic use of this handwritten technology helps turn in the modern period a scroll into a sacred object rather than a more conventionally rational, useful object. And the truth is that most manuscripts, when we talk about Hebrew manuscripts, we're much more likely to talk about codices. We're much more likely to talk about printed books like this one. Is everybody seeing the manuscript book in front of us, which we'll talk about in a few more minutes, right? This is bound as a book. That's the pretty standard format of Hebrew manuscripts that are collected today. And the reason for that, if we go backwards, is because scrolls are enormously inferior technology for carrying text than is a bound book, bound in the way that we're used to. If we go back, not in the National Library of Israel's collection, this is in the Shrine of the Book Israel Museum collection. If we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, even from several centuries prior to the Common Era. So these are scrolls. They're scrolls because the technology of binding things into what we would call a standard bound book did not exist at the time. And so the only available way to copy the texts that they wanted, in this case, say for Yeshayahu, the book of Isaiah, or in this case, the war scroll, Qumran Cave 1. And you can see if you read Hebrew that the Hebrew here is perfectly legible. We'll see some examples later on of Hebrew writing that is much less legible. But here also, it's a scroll because that's the technology that they had. And scrolls are not an efficient way of recording text, because for two primary reasons that scrolls are inefficient. The first is you can really only use one side of your material, whether it's papyrus or parchment. You can't use both sides. And secondly, as anybody who knows, if anybody who's experienced the holiday of Simchat Torah just a little more than a week ago in our socially distanced street minyan, in our socially distanced street services, we had one Torah scroll. We had to read both from the end of Deuteronomy, the end of Dvarim, and the beginning of Bereishit. And it took us several minutes to roll the scroll from beginning to end to get from place to place, as opposed to a standard issue book like we have today, where I can simply flip through it and get easily from page to page. So when they invented binding, as we're familiar with in bound books today, roughly in the second century CE, the technology of scrolls gradually faded away, and bound codices, handwritten books in the form of books that we're familiar with today, became more common. We'll hold that thought for a minute when we spend more time on codices a little bit later, but suffice it to say that there is a dispute among historians about when and why Jews adopted the codex. And there are some historians who claim the Jews adopted the codex much later than Christian communities did. We'll talk about that. I'm not personally convinced. So in addition to scrolls, which we have today's ritual scrolls, but also ancient historical scrolls meant to preserve text, another kind of even simpler technology, not even the scroll, is going to be a single page document. And therefore, we have thousands upon thousands of single paged documents that serve as Hebrew manuscripts. And these can take on all kinds of forms. Here we have an example, manuscript Hebrew 8333.29 from the National Library of Israel's collection acquired just a couple of years ago. This is a letter to Siman Tov ben Yehuda ibn Daniel from Yair, his brother-in-law. And it is part of the so-called Afghan Gniza, a little bit of background on that. We're dealing here with a letter from the 12th century. 12th century from the so-called Silk Road, the letter was sent to the city of Bamyan in Afghanistan, today's Afghanistan, most famous for the Taliban blowing up the Buddhist statues in the city of Bamyan. And we know of several hundred pages of documents from the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, from the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries from this area in Afghanistan. The National Library of Israel is the only public institution that has documents from this collection. And this is a letter we have about 300 pages of documents. This particular document, you can see up here at the top, the address or the person it's written to is written in Persian in standard Arabic characters of the time. And then the letter itself is written in Judeo-Arabic. That is to say, excuse me, in Judeo-Persian, it's written in Persian in Hebrew characters. And it's basically a long, forlorn letter of the brother-in-law, the less successful brother-in-law, to his more successful family in Bamyan, describing a situation in which he's been kicked out of the community. He's fled to another city. He misses his wife and his children. There were accusations that he wasn't honest in business. There was accusations that he didn't properly keep Shabbat. And he's asking for advice. And between the lines of the letter, you could understand that he's asking also for money to assist him in coming back to Bamyan, which he would very much like to do. Okay, so you have manuscripts in the form of letters, which again, scholars are going to use for understanding language. They're going to use understanding the basic socioeconomics of the condition and the time and place. And one of the remarkable things about this letter is that this stash of documents, the 300 pages that we have and several hundred other pages that we know of in private collections from this material, is basically the only documentation that exists at all about the medieval Jewish community in Afghanistan prior to the Genghis Khan and the Mongols who invaded in the 1230s and basically laid waste to the whole area. So these are super important documents. We also have letters. This is a marvelous letter. This is in Judeo-Arabic. This is from a letter from the 12th century, roughly from the 12th century. And if you see, can you see my cursor? Okay, so if you see my cursor, you'll see I'm surrounding the word Rivka. This is a marvelous, marvelous letter. It's a marvelous letter from the Cairo Geniza. I'm not going to spend too long on the Cairo Geniza, but roughly a collection of 300,000 to 400,000 documents that was preserved in Fustat, in the old city of Cairo, and brought to the West at the end of the 19th century and early 20th centuries. It's one of the most important archaeological and textual finds anywhere ever. This is a marvelous, marvelous letter from the Karaite community of Jerusalem, sending a letter to the Karaite community of Egypt, which is really the center of Karaite life. Contrary to what people often believe today, the Karaites were not fully a separate sect of Judaism that had nothing to do with rabbinics. There were close connections between Karaites and Rabbinites, and even cross a marriage between families. In any case, this is a marvelous letter in which two suitors, one here you can see his name's Suleiman, and the woman Rivka, there's two, and there's also Shimon over here. These are the characters in our story. Two men are wooing the woman Rivka, and one of the men forges a marriage document, a ketubah, indicating that he married her. The other one threatens to kill the other one for lying about this situation. It's a wonderful letter, even though it's a horrific letter. And basically the Karaite community, leaders of the Karaite community in Jerusalem, are writing a letter to the Karaite community of Fustat and saying, you guys figure this out. You're really in charge. We don't know what to do with these two jerks who are making everybody's life miserable. And you can see also the writing, in the margins, which is upside down. Paper was very valuable. This is a 12th century paper document. And paper was very valuable. And it's very hard to organize a letter. You can't delete things the way we do in emails today. So often letters have, and we'll see more examples of marginal writing as we keep going. So, or a single document like a ketubah, and we can contrast, let's say, this absolutely stunning 18th century Italian ketubah. We can contrast that to another ketubah from the Cairo Geniza from Tzur, from the city of Tyre in Lebanon in 1023. This is the oldest. We have several thousand ketubot at the National Library. This is the oldest of them. It's 997 years old. That goes back pretty far. And you can see that this ketubah, beside the fact that the text is longer And the text is longer here because it actually goes into a great, it's really a functioning prenup. And it has a great deal of information about the property that the woman brought into the marriage and the husband brought into the marriage and rights of moving and whether or not the husband can move back to his hometown without the permission or with the permission of his wife. They're really getting into the nitty gritty. And this is, you know, fully speaking, a proper legal document, a prenup. And by the time you look at this text from Italy in the 18th century, it's become less of, it's part of a much, much longer trend in which the ketubah today, it has legal implications, especially halachic implications, but it's more or less unenforceable for, among other reasons, that nobody knows what the exchange rate is between the zoos and the Canadian dollar. But even if we were to figure out the exchange rate, it's become much more of a ritual document, and therefore it became likely to become symbolic and therefore decorated, especially once notions of romance and beauty and the like come into the conversation in the course of the Renaissance, especially in Italy. So then ketubot take on this romance, love, decoration, gift element. It would be pretty hard to imagine, for example, one of us today decorating the deed to our apartment, the rental contract from which we rent our current apartment. It would be really weird to decorate such a thing, and it would have been bizarre in the 11th century to decorate a ketubah. But once it becomes a ritual item, much as the old technology of a scroll was once the way of copying information, becomes a ritual object when there are alternatives. So here, once the document of the ketubah becomes or starts drifting in the direction of legally being less significant, and once the features of romance and love become more important culturally, so then it becomes decorated. So we have scrolls, we have single page documents, letters and legal documents and ketubot, and we also have codices. And as I mentioned before, codices are the standard way. If somebody says a Hebrew manuscript, this appears in a Hebrew manuscript, more often than not, they're talking about a codex. A codex. And a codex is bound book, but hand written. And that's what makes it a manuscript. This is an image of what's probably the most important manuscript in the National Library of Israel's collection. It's Maimonides' autograph, Rambam's autograph copy of Perusha Mishnayot, of the commentary on the Mishnah, in his own handwriting. And it's close to the final version. You can see a couple of places over here where there are emendations in Rambam's own handwriting. And then you can see some marginal notes, which are generally in this manuscript from later generations. And it's one of several examples of Maimonides' own handwriting that are known. We have more examples of Rambam, Maimonides' own handwriting, than we do of just about any of the other great medieval rabbis. And you can also see here the work that the restoration, it wasn't actually the National Library's restoration team, it was the Sassoon family's restoration team, which they did to restore this book. You can see here the edge of what remained of the original manuscript. But this was originally a bound text. And the advantage of bound texts is that they're much easier to find things. You can flip through things, you can read things, you can go back and forth very easily, which is very, very difficult to do with a scroll. So here we're dealing with an example of somebody who is carefully and cautiously writing a document for their own use. Maimonides Rambam is aware of the significance of what he's doing. He knows that he's writing an important book. This is his early work. He hasn't yet reached the fame that he would achieve later in his life, but he still realizes that this is a book he's going to publish. I'm just going to mention briefly that the very word publishing is a little bit hard to talk about or requires a lot of thinking. Because if you're not making multiple copies of the same text, what does it mean to publish something? I'm going to leave that as an open question. Maybe we can talk about it later if we have time. But suffice it to say that the Rambam was aware of the fact that he was writing a book, even though he couldn't just print off 500 or 1,000 or print on demand. And so he's being cautious. But then we look at another example, late 19th, early 20th century manuscript from Yemen, a prayer before Kiddush on Pesach, and you see that the writing is more childish, that the lines are not as careful. The lines are bending. The spacing is not professional. It almost looks like childish handwriting. It's possible that it was, but certainly we're dealing with a layperson who is copying the text of this prayer for himself. Normally, I would say him or herself, but we're on pretty safe ground when we say that it's himself. And so here we're dealing with a careful copyist, of a person who really knows what they're doing. And here we're dealing with a more amateur copyist who's writing. And if the Rambam manuscript is for public use, an expectation that this is going to go out into the general public and have an influence, then this manuscript is almost certainly for private use. It's going to be used to recite these prayers before Kiddush on Passover in one's home. Here's another example. This is actually by a professional scribe, but here also you can see this is a 16th century collection of halachic writings, Ashkenazi collection of halachic writings. And you can see Din Hasarat Se'ar Rashi Kvasim, mostly a collection of copied halachic texts about Kashrut and Shchita, although this manuscript has all kinds of other stuff thrown into it as well and bound together. But here we have a professional scribe, but also somebody who's not really working to make this beautiful or careful. The lines are a little more even, but they're not totally lined up. So we have somebody who's hired a professional scribe, but wants the work done relatively quickly and relatively inexpensively. As opposed to this 13th and 14th century slichot, according to the Ashkenazi custom. And here you can see this is an absolute professional scribe, calligraphic letters, carefully written. You can even see the srita, the lines that are done, that are made on the parchment. There are various different ways, and people who are really experts at this can look at the way the lines are formed, among other things, and roughly give an estimate of the age of a document based and the place of a document, really largely just based on those sorts of features themselves. So here we see Slichot Liyom HaKippurim, and this is a real professional scribe. You can also see that this is on parchment, and you can also see enormous large margins, enormously large margins. And that's a sign of real wealth. We'll talk about margins a little bit later on, because they're also important for marginal notes, for people to take notes for themselves. But here it's also a sign of wealth, because a document like this is also a very large manuscript. One of the things that it's very difficult to get across in a PowerPoint is how the size of these things, which really makes a difference. This is a fairly large manuscript, and the single most expensive part of a manuscript this size is the parchment. We're talking about a flock of sheep, basically, who have given up their lives for the sake of our ability to say slichot. So leaving wide margins is a sign of wealth. This shows that this is a really wealthy donor, a powerful family. Who has commissioned this kind of a manuscript. Here also we have, but this is a document on paper. And so the margins are also large, but it's less of an investment. Now, there's Malachi Beit Aryeh, the great historian of Hebrew manuscripts, has argued and demonstrated convincingly that in the Christian world, the percentage of manuscripts that are professionally copied is much higher. And that's for two reasons. First of all, because the rate of literacy among Christians is lower than among Jews. That's not to say that every Jew was perfectly literate, but Jews were were literate at a higher percentage than were members of the Christian population. And secondly, the Christian population had a professional institute for manuscript copying in the High Middle Ages of the scriptorium, also scriptoria in monasteries, and also in university towns, there would be for-profit businesses that would copy texts that were necessary for studies. Jews, for the most part, did not have institutions of this kind, and it was much more likely for a Jew to find a copy of something that was available. A neighbor, somebody passing through town, somebody from the next town had a copy of a text that I wanted, and I'm much more likely to simply copy it myself or have it copied quickly and cheaply by somebody who's not necessarily a professional. I say cheaply, not really cheaply. It's an enormous expense. And also we should keep in mind that we'll talk about this also somewhat later. If there was a synagogue that had a copy of Slichot, this kind of a manuscript would go to the Chazan. And most of the people sitting in the synagogue probably did not have a copy of the Slichot at all. It was simply too expensive. And so the role of the Chazan, of course, changes dramatically in a period today when everybody can walk into their, get on Amazon and buy whatever prayer book you want with whatever translation you want or whatever commentary you want and have it shipped Amazon Prime to you to arrive at your door the next day. So the meaning of having a prayer book was very different. And this was a rare treat of an item for a community that most people probably didn't have for themselves. Now, if we talk about margins, now's a good opportunity to talk. Here's a document also with a professional copyist. This is a 1320 copy of the Hebrew translation of Ibn Sina's Great Canon. Ibn Sina was a 11th century, 10th century, I don't remember, Muslim scholar who among his very important works was the Great Canon, which is a summary of previous medical knowledge. And it had already been translated into Latin at this time in the 13th century, in the late 13th century. There's a Hebrew translation, and this is a early 14th century copy of the Hebrew translation. And you can see that it's very, very heavily marked up. You can see that it's very heavily marked up in the margins because this was a reference book for actual work. And the doctor is sitting there. He's looking things up. He's making comments. He's adding additions that he has learned from other sources, comparing other texts. But here also you can see the work of a professional scribe in the details and more. Here you can also see manicules. Excuse me, didn't mean to do that. You can also see manicules. These are these little hand thingies here in the margin, which are kind of a way of, they're like one of those little post-it note flags that you might put in a book. Say, oh, I want to go back to this at some point. So you could go in the margin. Oh, this is where he deals with, you know, the common cold, or this is where he deals with hemorrhoids. That's going to come up again. I better flag that spot for when people come in with a runny nose or whatever it is that they have. And you can also see that the marginal notes are different hands. They're written by different people. This is a very different hand than this. You can also see, if you look here at the bottom, there's this long marginal note and it's cut off at the bottom. And it's cut off at the bottom because bookbinders were bastards. And they infuriate me to no end. But somebody at some point owned this manuscript, brought it in to be rebound, and the binder just hacked off the margins because the piece of wood was the wrong size, because the binding materials he had were the wrong size, because the owner wanted it to fit on a certain shelf, because the binder wasn't aware of the fact that there were notes in the margins. And binders were like, I hope I don't insult anybody. They're like the graphic designers of today, where you ask them to fix one thing, and then it ends up having implications for the whole rest of the document you're working on. They're like, sorry, that's not my job. I'm not going to deal with that. They do exactly what you tell them to do, and then they don't think about the implications. That wasn't nice to graphic designers, but at least in my experience, sometimes that happens. So, you know, codices like these get heavily marked up. Rabbinic texts will also get marked up as well. Now, notice that none of the documents, with the exception of the ketubah that we've seen thus far, are illuminated. And when people think of Hebrew manuscripts, when people think of medieval manuscripts, the first thing that jumps into their head are these beautiful illuminations, the beautiful colored documentation, the gold leaf, the pictures, what have you. And in fact, a absolutely minuscule percentage of manuscripts from the Middle Ages are illuminated. But they get a lot of attention because they're beautiful. For the most part, illuminations are so expensive that that people do not, for the most part, use them. If you just want to copy a text who has time, energy, money to decorate it. Now, we can talk about first class illuminations. This is a 14th century. The truth is, it was probably copied in roughly 1350 and then decorated in roughly 1400, probably copied in Spain and then decorated in Italy. This is a copy of Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Enormous. It must be a meter 20, a meter 30 tall. Enormous on parchment copy of Rambam's Mishneh Torah, his code of Jewish law. And at least the first quarter of it, roughly, are absolutely beautifully illuminated with these marginal angels and baby faces and putti and whatever. And then these stunning gold leaf illustrations at the beginning. Here we have Sefer Ahava, the book of love, which is starts, I don't know if you can see it clearly down here at the bottom. It starts with Hilchot Kriyat Shema. And so we have an image here at the bottom of a person laying down to bed, but before going to bed, reciting Kriyat Shema, reciting the Shema prayer, which is to be said prior to falling asleep. Now, if we look at the upper gold leaf, we see Sefer Ahava, Ma Ahavti Toratecha Kol Hayom Yisichati, how much do I love your Torah? It is my conversation all day. Because Sefer Ahava includes, the theme of Ma'ahavti Toratecha, connect Sefer Ahava, even though the laws of Talmud Torah are actually in a different book, but the connection of Ahava, of how much have I loved your Torah, connects to the book of Ahava. And here you see a man wrapped in a cloak, clutching a Sefer Torah. You can see his beard. The detail here is extremely fine. I don't know if it comes across on across the airwaves, but he's cradling the Sefer Torah, the scroll of the Torah, almost like a baby, to get across this notion of ahavata Torah, of love of Torah. And there's no doubt at all that the investment that the donor makes to illuminate a manuscript like this one is itself an expression of ahava, in addition to an expression of wealth and showing offness. Sarit Shalev Eini has suggested that among the reasons why they would illuminate a book of law, which is really meant to be studied, is because there was competition between Maimonides' code and the Tur. And fans of Maimonides' code over the Tur wanted to show that theirs was the real winner, perhaps. Here we have an 18th century Megillah scroll from Amsterdam, Megillat Esther. You can see the 10 sons of Haman being hanged. This is more of a pen drawing. And you can see here the extreme detail. The celebration of the Jews after the defeat in battle. And here's an absolutely stunning Ashkenazi manuscript from roughly the 14th century. You can see the detailed line work. This is a machzor for Yom Kippur. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Veloke Avoteinu. This is the beginning of Amidah. And you can see the little dragon here, another dragon over here, another dragon over here. And I don't know if this is a dragon or a lion over here in the bottom left-hand corner, but extremely, extremely subtle pen drawings and decorations. You also have this, I don't know if it's a dragon or a griffin or something there in the middle. We'll talk about why they chose some of the sense of humor here. We also have second class illuminations. This is from an 18th century Sefer Evronot, just in parentheses. manuscripts did not disappear with the founding of the printing press. The first Hebrew printings, the late 1460s, manuscripts continue. Not only wasn't there that much Hebrew printing until the middle of the 16th century, there were even in the middle of the 16th century, there were all kinds of texts you couldn't get printed. But even later than that, manuscripts were often used after the founding of printing, whether in communities that didn't have access, easy access to printed books, or in this case, probably to decorate just for the sake of the beauty. There was a rise of Hebrew manuscript art, and not only Hebrew manuscript art, in the 18th century in Central Europe. And this is an example of a Sefer Evronot, a book of intercalculating how to calculate the Jewish calendar, which has all of its charts here. On this side, Mazal Gdi, which is January, written in Latin characters, and you have several images in this manuscript indicating the beginning of summer, June, March, and the like in this manuscript. There's also micography. Micography, the idea of making an image out of minuscule letters, is largely a Jewish art. It's largely a Jewish art, in particular because it stems from not so much these examples. This is a 1280 Catalonian machzor for Yom Kippur. We have a hunting scene over here, and here we just have a kind of carpet-like design. But the reason why micography becomes a Jewish art is because of the Masoretic Notes. The Masoretic Notes are sets of notes that were written in 8th century, 9th century, trying to establish the precise and exact text of the Bible. And by the time we hit the High Middle Ages, they're largely not being used anymore for that purpose, but the tradition is to copy them in the margins. So a real professional copyist had this text that had to be copied in the margin of a Bible that nobody was expected to read or understand. And so they would often use the letters in a design shape so that the text would be there, the Masoretic Notes would be there, but they'd essentially be a decorative situation. And here you can see a somewhat enlargement of some of the micography. Here we have some kind of a snake or a serpent or some such. You also have carpet pages. This is a Bible from the 1260s in which the opening and closing pages are designed to look like Islamic-influenced or Muslim-influenced carpets, more carpet pages from the same manuscript, or also decorated incipits. The opening word would be decorated. This is a Portuguese manuscript from the 15th century, a sidur, and here you can see some of the detail, the detailed and colorful line work that's done to decorate the incipits, the opening letters. Now, as we saw, we already saw examples of dragons and the like. And the truth is that especially, though not exclusively, in Italy and in Ashkenaz, in Europe, the illuminations on the small minority of manuscripts that were illuminated were often full of senses of humor. They were also very often illuminated by Gentiles. Really, only a Jew could copy the text, because only Jews really were literate in Hebrew or the relevant language. But you could take your manuscript to a workshop of a Christian artist, get better art for less money, and all you had to do was describe for the Christian artist what it is that you wanted. So you'll get this. I don't know if this was a Jewish or non-Jewish artist. I don't think it's the you know, top of the line illustration, but here we have a Sefer Mitzvot Katan, the small book of Mitzvot, or the concise book of Mitzvot from the Ashkenazi 14th century. A trumpet playing frog, a horn blowing bear, or whatever this is. What does that have to do with the text? Nothing at all. Nothing at all whatsoever. It's really just an opportunity to have some fun. And if you see over here, you've got this knight in shining armor, a rabbit with a funny looking tail, and the like. These are the kinds of things that we're likely to see in illuminations of manuscript. I see it a little bit as like a tie in men's formal wear. One of the reasons I came to Israel was to avoid having to wear ties anymore. And but you know, the suit itself and the outfit is pretty formal and pretty scripted, but you can have a little fun with the ties, and at least in the last generation with the socks also, right? You can add some color and some personality, even though you're basically wearing a dull, dark suit. Here we have another example, a 14th century Rashi, Chumash with Rashi. We also have these, I don't know if they're foxes or likely dragons, have nothing whatsoever to do with the first words of the Book of Shemot. Probably the most famous example of having fun in manuscript illustrations is the famed Kennicott Bible. Benjamin Kennicott, the important 18th century collector. He was less of a collector and actually more of a scholar of the text of the Bible. And he was very, very interested in comparing different versions of texts of the Bible. And he collected, he didn't write this. This is a 15th century Spanish manuscript, probably the most beautiful and stunningly illuminated Hebrew manuscript of the entire Middle Ages. And in the colophon is a term for the, it was actually written and copied by, and then the Nikud was also done by the same scribe, and then the illustrations were done by another scribe, a Jewish scribe, a Jewish artist. Here we see Ani Yosef ibn Chaim Zeh HaSefer Tziarti VeHishlamti. I am Yosef, the son of Chaim. This is the book which I have drawn and I have completed. And he creates the letters of this colophon, the places where he introduces himself as the copyist, or in this case as the artist, out of images, ridiculous images of people, and really with no sense of propriety, or what we would call propriety today. We have the naked man with the bird head. We have the naked woman. We have various kinds of grotesque creatures and animals that make up the colophon. The letters are literally made out of these absurd, grotesque, even vulgar kinds of images. And manuscript copyists were pretty dull, boring people. And I don't know if they were boring people, but they were, they did boring work. And this was really an opportunity for them to go out and show themselves to their community of readers. A couple of words briefly, because I see I'm running out of time, about economics. We talked a little bit about the idea that more Jews than Christians would copy texts for themselves. This is an example of the Worms Master 1272. It's the first example of written Yiddish in the world. And if you see here, it says you see if the red letters in the hollow space of the letters, the red letters in the hollow space of the letters read out the first example of written Yiddish that's known. Gutak im betaga shir dismachzer im beis haknesses traga. A blessing to the person who carries this machzer to the synagogue. And that's because this is a gigantic two-volume machzer. It's actually, well, not so clear that it's two volumes, but whatever. Gigantic machzer. It's to be brought to the Beit Knesset, to the synagogue. What does that indicate? That the machzer was owned by an individual who held onto it and brought it for community use on the holidays. And what that suggests, and scholars consider this a model for how manuscript ownership worked, there weren't public libraries, and there likely were not particularly examples of publicly owned books. Private individuals owned books, commissioned books, bought and sold books. We don't find in this period ownership notes to communities. We don't find a note for the most part that says this is owned by a community. It's owned by individuals. And it's only in the early modern period that individuals start treating their own personal collections as a public resource. And then in the later modern period, the notion of public libraries. So something like this is commissioned by an individual, owned by an individual, and then lent to the community for use. Here's the whole page of that. Here's another page from the Worms Machzor, and yet another page. Okay, I see that we're basically running out of time. So just very, very quickly to look at some examples of different kinds of script. We're used to this kind of a square, Sephardic square script. This is what we typically call Hebrew square script today. This is an example of Sephardic semi-cursive script. It looks an awful lot like what we call Rashi script. Rashi script had nothing whatsoever to do with Rashi. Rashi did not write in Rashi script. Rashi wrote in an Ashkenazi cursive hand almost certainly, although we have no examples of his own handwriting. And the reason why it's called Rashi script is because with the founding of printing, printers would use a separate font, a semi-cursive font for the commentaries around the margins of books. And since more often than not, the relevant commentary in the most important books was Rashi, both the Talmud and the Chumash. So that semi-cursive script really has its origins in Sephardi semi-cursive script, becomes Rashi script, but Rashi had nothing to do with it, right? And here we have a little bit of a closer example, which is, again, closer to what we call Rashi script today. Here we have a variation, a Land of Israel script, square script, so it's much easier to read. This is all an enormous Tanakh from the 10th century in the Land of Israel, but also you can have scripts like this, Oriental cursive scripts, which can be very, very difficult to read and really look more like Arabic. But the truth is, here's a Yemenite square script as well, Ashkenazi script, which is much more angular and influenced. Ashkenazi medieval square and semi-cursive script in this case, much more angular, influenced by Gothic script, or an Ashkenazi modern script, cursive modern script, which looks like more like typical kind of Israeli chicken scratch handwriting today, but can also be very difficult to read. Finally, we'll end with kind of three different or really two different scripts here in an Ashkenazi manuscript, an 1800 manuscript, again, demonstrating that manuscripts didn't die with the printed books. This is the Chevra Kadisha in an unknown Eastern European town commissioned this. And here you have a kind of an Ashkenazi square script of what's said at a funeral. And then in both Hebrew and in Yiddish, in a cursive script, and the Yiddish in a script called Otiot Tzur, Tsena Urena letters, which were typical script used and printed font used for Yiddish as well, all on one page. And this is kind of a sign, even as late as the 1800s, that a manuscript could be used to beautify the mitzvah. This is kind of a calling card, an investment on the part of a Chevra Kadisha, on the part of a burial society, to demonstrate just how seriously they take their work, and including, of course, translations for Yiddish, because illiterate men and women were obviously involved in the burial society because they needed to be. Okay, that is my very, very, very brief introductory run-through on Hebrew manuscripts as objects, cultural objects, physical objects. And we have a couple of minutes for questions. If I can take a look at the chat, I don't know if I can. Let me see if I can.
If you can't, let me know and I'll read the questions. Otherwise, take a quick look at the chat. Thank you very much.
Okay. Gender dynamics. And Jericho Vincent is asking about gender dynamics in manuscripts. There are a handful of examples of medieval involvement of women in copying manuscripts, and a few examples of women's involvement in early printing presses and even in later printing presses. But for the most part, this is men's work. It's men's work because men are more literate. It's men's work because men are more likely to have the training and the knowledge to work in manuscripts. Beautiful manuscripts were often given as gifts to women. And some of the most beautiful manuscripts we have, especially we saw the example of the Ketubah, but there's also prayer books written for women, which are often given as wedding presents going back to the Renaissance. But for the most part, women are more passive consumers than they are producers. And they're more passive and a smaller percentage of the consumers than are the men. Somebody mentioned that a hey looks like a chet. Yes, that's pretty common in a lot of scripts. Somebody asked about what percentage of illuminated Hebrew manuscripts are illuminated by Christians. We don't know the answer to that question because in more cases than not, we can't identify who was the illuminator. But since you can compare the work sometimes to known schools or known workshops, sometimes you could figure it out. There's also bunches of examples of mistakes that only a Christian would make, like the illumination being upside down or God having a face. Those are the kinds of things that that indicate that some of them were Christians. Could the trumpet-playing frog be a French Jew? It could be. And there are definitely scholars who try to read omni-significance in these drawings. I'm skeptical. I'm not convinced by it. I think Occam's razor says, if it looks like somebody having fun and smells like somebody having fun and acts like somebody having fun, it's probably somebody having fun. But I know very, very serious scholars who think otherwise, that there's a lot more thought and detail. Okay, where do manuscripts come from? The answer is all over the Jewish world. Anywhere there were Jews, to the extent that the material is still preserved, we have manuscripts. And that's going to range from, you know, North America in the late modern, postmodern period, if you will, you know, going all the way back to the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have manuscripts from China, from the Far East, from Afghanistan, from India. The National Library just recently bought a manuscript of Tfilot with instructions in Judeo-Urdu. From India, Pakistan, Turkey, the Caucasus, Eretz Yisrael, North Africa, Italy, Spain, Ashkenaz, Western Europe, Eastern Europe. To the extent that these materials were preserved, we have them. And in terms of piyutim, some are preserved in manuscript, some are not preserved. We know that there were piyut X, but we don't have a text of it. And many of them were preserved through printing. In terms of vocalization, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't know that we necessarily pronounce words and letters in the same way, that we do today. Okay. Did I miss any questions?
If you want to post the link where on the National Library website, if people want to see more of the manuscripts, I assume there's some like public link.
Yeah, you can go to the website at nli.org.il. I would in particular encourage you to sign up for the newsletter and also for the blog, which I'm just going to quickly Google and give you the link to the librarian's blog. At the National Library of Israel. We also have very, very active Facebook groups of various kinds and active Twitter feeds, Facebook groups dedicated to Hebrew manuscripts, to Hebrew printing, to life before the Holocaust, to general interest and the like.
Somebody's also asking, didn't some of the pictures, I guess that's what you're referring to, have God at the top with faces? I mean, so, you could have that in the Middle Ages, those who didn't accept the Rambam's view, you know, that before the Rambam.
It's pretty rare. Is it possible? There are a handful of examples also in the ancient world of, you know, God in the center of the signs of the zodiac on a floor of a synagogue with God having a face. It's not absolutely foreign, but it's pretty rare in Jewish tradition to depict God with a face. is it possible that that's what the Jew asked for? And, you know, in examples that we know, and some of the, at least one of the examples that I know of where God is depicted with a face, it was then crossed out afterwards. It was covered up. So is that a mistake on the part of the copyist? Or is that a, or is that a change of mind of the community after they inherited it? I don't know, but it's among the reasons that people will give for suspecting that the work was done by a Christian illustrator.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I want to thank also DJ Schneeweiss, who I see is on board, our former neighbor when he was the Council General for Israel in Canada, for West Ontario and Western Canada, and also has undergone a career change and has moved from the world of diplomacy to working in the National Library, and DJ for making our shidduch and for recommending this, and it's nice to see you, DJ, every once in a while. So welcome and thank you. And he is working, Ilana mentioned, if anybody has any information that they'd like to know on the library, you can email him. The email is there. So Dr. Yoel, I want to thank you. Rabbi Dr. Yoel, you know, it's interesting, if I can say, I know you spoke once many years ago for us at Torah in Motion on the book you wrote. What I forget what it's called, but what Jews are reading. It's sort of so opposite. Like, it was about, you know, what the newspapers and the magazines that are so, like, I'd say less serious.
The commonality, which I didn't really, I think, understand myself until actually Stephen Fine pointed it out to me, professor at YU. He said, I know what you're interested in.
But I'm not.
Somebody's microphone is still on. I'm interested in texts and their social context.
Right.
And I think that that's part of the commonality.
I find it interesting how you switch, you know, so from that to this, but really a pleasure. Thank you very much. Of course, welcome everybody. In 13 minutes, Dr. Benny Gesundheit will be doing part 5 on his series on Tehillim. He's a masterful teacher. Those who have been on, if you haven't, I recommend you stay. Go take a cup of coffee and a drink and come back. We'll start at 12:15. Tomorrow morning, Marty Lekshin begins his series on biblical commentaries they didn't teach you in yeshiva, starting on Shadal. That's what we'll be doing tomorrow. Tomorrow night, Dr. Moshe Sokolov will be starting his ongoing series on the Haftarah of the week. Instead of our Parsha Shir of the week will go on Thursday night, and Thursday morning, Shuli Miskin on archaeology and the land of Israel. And then continuing next week with Menachem Liebtag on Cyrus to Balfour, etc. Okay, so we look forward to seeing you. Keep the same channel, Zoom channel is always active. Yes.
Yeah. What about the Aleppo Codex? So you did mention that.
I didn't actually. The 10th century Bible that I had showed before. Let me see if I can go back to it. This 10th century Bible looks very much like the Aleppo Codex. The Aleppo Codex is not in the National Library of Israel's collection. It's in the Shrine of the Book / Israel Museum collection. It has a very, very long story of its own. Certainly the most important biblical manuscript of the Masoretic text that we have, and unfortunately not complete, partially stolen over the course of years. But it looks very much like this one because it's from the same time and same place. Only the Aleppo Codex is much more important for the history of the Masoretic text.
Okay. Also, did the library buy any of the Lunzer collection, the Valmadana Library?
Yeah, the National Library bought about 80% of the Valmadana collection. We got I'm forgetting the exact number at this point, but about 80% of the collection, thousands upon thousands of volumes, mostly printed books. And they'll actually be in display in our new building, which should in the rare book room, and then the new building, which should go live some point in 2022.
Oh, very good. Okay. Where did the rest go?
Scattered to various private collectors.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? And we'll let Dr. Yoel go. And Now he's back in his office, I guess. Nice. Hopefully they can open up the library to the public soon.
God willing.
It's improving, you know, in Israel at least. We'll see how this lockdown goes, you know. But please God, it should go a lot better than the last one.
Yeah, I hope so.
That's anyways, okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jay.
Okay, thank you. Nice to see you.
Thanks
okay,
to everybody who participated.
Have a great day, everybody. Okay, be well. And Dr. Benny, in 10 minutes, everybody can wait, and we'll see you. We'll continue in a few minutes. Thank you.